Chariot TechCast Episode 55, an interview with Boris Bukowski on the Eclipse E4 project. Welcome to the show. My guest today, Boris Bukowski, has been an Eclipse developer for a long time, dating back actually to when he contributed the CVS client to the toolset. His background includes developing rich client applications with Eclipse RCP and GEF, and is now working on the Eclipse E4 project, an incubator for delivering the next generation features to the platform. Mr. Bukowski is a senior software developer at IBM and Eclipse platform UI committer. We start by talking about his background with Eclipse, and we end up by discussing the release train, including 3.6 and 4.0 of Eclipse. 4.0 is due sometime towards the end of July. Let's give it a listen. My guest today is Boris Bukowski. He's a senior software developer at IBM, and he's been working with Eclipse for a very long time. His title, I guess, on the Eclipse team is Eclipse Platform UI Committer. Now, your participation dates all the way back to 1.0 of Eclipse, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So tell us a little bit about those days.
I think it was 2000 when I moved to Canada with my young family and started to work on Eclipse before it was called Eclipse. Back then, I worked on the CVS integration, like the first version of that.
You were a savior for that, I'm sure. Everybody needed that.
So it's, well, back then, everybody here in Ottawa where I was working had a previous experience with version control stuff, but not with CVS. Mm-hmm. And I had my little SourceForge project, so that
you brought it to the table, right? Yeah. Okay, so you worked on that, and then I also read in your bio that you did work with a rich client platform. So tell me a little bit about your rich client platform experience with Eclipse. And you said in there it said that you were using the Eclipse modeling framework and graphical editing framework. So what was it like to code applications with RCP and GEF?
So this was a couple of years later when I was doing something for a friend who had a consulting company in Munich. And he was looking at getting his consulting method, supported by some software tool. And it's all about large diagrams, managing data. And I suggested that I can build something for him based on Eclipse RCP and using the modeling framework for structuring the data.
Right.
This is not about generating code necessarily. It's just for having a standard way to talk about what is your data model.
Mm-hmm. Visualizing it.
And then the graphical editing framework, the GEF project at eclipse.org, is what gives you graphical editing capabilities of that data.
Okay. So basically the modeling framework represents the model in some way, and the graphical editing framework visualizes that for you.
Yeah, exactly. It's the visualizing, and then how do you interact with that? In which ways can you manipulate it using mouse and keyboard and things like that?
So in building a rich client platform back then, were you just basically building a project that used the Eclipse APIs, or were you actually building like OSGI bundles and things like that?
So I think by necessity, you're building OSGI bundles when you're building an Eclipse-based product. Mm-hmm. That's just the way Eclipse works. You start with a basic platform, and then you add bundles or plugins. We use those terms interchangeably.
Now. Right, yeah. And you're building on Equinox, if I remember correctly, right? Isn't that the base of Eclipse?
Yes, and then Equinox is the OSGI implementation that Eclipse uses. And
right.
That has been developed as part of Eclipse.
Okay.
But you don't really see that much of it. All you see of it is you structure your project or your product into these different pieces and modules or bundles, whatever you want to call them. And then for each of them, you define what the public API is, so you can hide certain things. Mm-hmm. But you don't really see the OSGI API necessarily if you're just building a product that's based on the Eclipse platform.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you did your rich client app, and then you came back to engage with the Eclipse Foundation, working on Eclipse, and now the big effort now is E4.
Yeah. So maybe to make that clear, I'm working for IBM, and the Eclipse Foundation is an independent foundation, and a whole lot of companies are members there, actually.
Oh, thanks for qualifying.
IBM,
yeah.
IBM being one of them. Mm-hmm. And there's no special rights that IBM has as part of the Eclipse Foundation. So a whole lot of other companies have seats on the board of directors, like Oracle, for example, and SAP and other companies like that, Nokia.
Right. So you're participating in the Eclipse project from IBM.
Yes.
You know, IBM's basically loaning you to them for the project, I assume.
Yeah, I work in an IBM office, and the way it works, the foundation doesn't have a lot of employees. They're basically running the infrastructure, and they have an executive director, things like that, a little bit of marketing. And then individuals or companies can run projects at eclipse.org, and that's how it works.
Okay.
All so right. on the Eclipse platform, we have... currently, it's mostly IBM, but there are some other companies participating and also individuals who've earned commit rights. And E4 is sort of our incubator project where we've made it really easy to become involved and become committer on the E4 project. And that's where we work on the innovative new stuff.
Okay. Is Eclipse 4 going to sprout out of E4? Is there going to be like I forget if there's a 3.6 release yet or not, but I saw, like, for example,
yes,
in the artifacts, there was a 3.6 in some of the downloads that I saw.
Exactly. So there's a 3.6 release of the Eclipse SDK that's going to ship in June this year. And then all the other Eclipse projects form, not all of them, but many of the other Eclipse projects participate in what we call the release train.
Mm-hmm.
This is basically a coordinated release of a lot of projects at Eclipse at around the same time. So
is that like Galileo, Callisto, all of those? Are those the release trains?
Yeah, exactly. And the current name is Helios,
mm-hmm,
and that's going to be released end of June as well.
Okay.
And then we have this other development stream, if you will, which is for Eclipse 4.0.
Mm-hmm.
So that's independent of the release train and will be shipped end of July. And that's basically some of the technology that we've developed as part of E4 and a compatibility layer that allows you to run existing 3.x Eclipse plugins on top of E4, plus all the stuff that we currently have as in the form of 3x plugins. That's the Java tooling, the plugin tooling, things like that. So all that together is the Eclipse 4.0 SDK. So it'll be basically the same functionality as Eclipse 3.6, except mm-hmm, it has a new platform on which it's built, and it'll have a new look.
Okay. So why don't we kind of put our sights towards the E4 and the Eclipse 4.0 platform and talk a little bit of kind of the big arc of features that are coming.
Okay, so basically there's two main things that we're looking at doing with E4. One is making it easier to develop individual components, UI components, like views and editors. And there's different ways in which we do that. One is we have a new programming model that's based on dependency injection and individual services, and I guess we'll talk about that in detail,
yep,
later.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have technology for writing UIs in a declarative way. So that's borrows some of the ideas or is structurally similar to what Microsoft is doing with XAML.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a fairly nice-looking XML-based format for describing UIs. And the third way in which we're making it easier to build individual UI components is we're making possible for open social gadgets to be hosted in Eclipse as views. And we can talk about that a little bit more, too.
Okay.
So then there's a second level at which we're trying to simplify things, and that second level is when you're looking at, you have all these components, and you want to assemble them into an application, a rich client application. And at that level, We want to make it easier too, but also more flexible so that Eclipse-based applications don't all look like Eclipse, for example.
Right. So why don't we so that's the UI side of things. And you also did mention kind of the dependency injection in the service layer. Really there's making it easy to write plugins, easy to write features of Eclipse, and also there's kind of the infrastructure underneath. I know that since Eclipse is OSGI based, and it was actually one of the earliest OSGI based tools that was out there that people started using, they mostly didn't even know they were using OSGI. What has been changed with the OSGI platform? Now, you call, I believe I'm correct about this, they're called, I'll say this wrong, bundles. Is that correct?
Yeah, so originally in Eclipse, we called them plugins. OSGI calls them bundles.
Correct.
And it's really the same thing. It's it's a jar that has metadata in a certain format. Basically, the manifest.mf file includes OSGI metadata. And the really what it is a version number for your jar and then a list of other bundles that you require and a list of packages from which you export API.
Right.
That's basically all you need to know about OSGI when you start with it.
Right, exactly. And so on top of OSGI then, or at least riding on OSGI, you've got Eclipse running on OSGI. How has it functioned in the past, and how are you enhancing the way that Eclipse communicates with its components? Or they communicate with each other, for that matter.
Yeah, so OSGI is sort of the structure that for the metadata and how you take components and define them and structure your application in a componentized way. But there's also OSGI APIs for accessing OSGI services, for example. And that's something that we haven't adopted right away. And maybe it wasn't there at the time that Eclipse adopted OSGI. I'm not quite sure. But if you... So this is... like if you want to bind to OSGI some more, then you can get a little bit more loose coupling between your bundles if you start using those OSGI services, where it's basically you say, I need the X service. Let's say it's a service for scheduling background work, and you don't really care about the implementation of that service. All you know is you want a certain API, and then it could be one of a few different implementations as long as they function the same way. And doing that with OSGI APIs has gotten a bit easier, but from our point of view, not easy enough. So in E4, we have made all the OSGI services available for UI components through dependency injection.
Okay. And those are the JSR 330 dependency injection annotations?
Yeah. So
like add inject?
Exactly. Yeah. I was part of the expert group of the JSR 330 effort. And E4 is one implementation of JSR 330 annotations.
Gotcha. Okay.
And dependency injection. And basically what you do is you make an OSGI service available, and that could be your domain-specific thing, like your database connection or your database or some other application-specific thing. And then you can just, in your view where you need that database connection, you can just write at inject database connection, my connection, and it'll be available.
Now, I know there was another dependency injection platform, which was SpringSource DM Server, and I know they recently donated that as Project Virgo. Is that making inroads in there at all? Is that a totally separate effort of the Eclipse project?
This is a separate Eclipse project, and it's just coming to Eclipse now. I think it's literally these weeks
where
they start putting the code in, and I haven't really looked at it. As far as I know, Spring also implements the JSR 330 spec.
Yeah.
I can't say much about Virgo.
Right.
At this point, I haven't had a chance to look at it in detail.
No, that's fair. The reason I was asking is because I know that if you look at people who are using OSGI and programming against it, They have concerns that they program around with things like DM, around things like if a bundle isn't there, you know, either pausing and waiting to request that bundle, you know, or getting a timeout, getting an error, things like, you know, the programmatic kind of edge cases around OSGI. And I'm assuming E4 is kind of taking care of that.
Yeah, in a sense, it's taking care of that. But it's also that normally that those edge cases don't occur in something like the Eclipse IDE.
Okay.
It's, you start the application and the stuff is there. Right, it's not that you've so you can theoretically upgrade your Eclipse while it's still running, and in some cases it actually works.
Right,
in others it doesn't because you're updating something that is too low level for us to update on the fly.
Right. Okay. So it can figure out by looking at the manifest what the order of, I guess, dependency and startup would need to be. Right, and that way you're not going to get those missing bundles and things like that.
Right. Okay. And if you really cared about making your system dynamic in the sense that you can keep it running and upgrade it on the fly or install new functionality on the fly, if you care about those aspects, then you start to get into those OSGI edge cases. But if you're just building a componentized app, then you don't really care about those dynamic aspects very much. What you do care about is the laziness.
Right.
You don't want everything to be active and up and running as your app comes up. You just want the minimal list of plugins. In the case of the Eclipse IDE, for example, the minimum list of plugins needed for displaying your initial screen, that needs to be loaded, but not much more.
Right. But then when you fire up JUnit, that plugin gets invoked and things like that.
Yeah, or even if you click on another editor that was in the background, but you had a tab for it because it was open in the last session, and let's say your front editor was a Java editor, so we have to load Java tooling when we come up, but the XML editor, say, that was in the background, if you bring that to the foreground, at that point we load the XML tooling stuff.
Right. So now, so in terms of the front end and the rich client, which is the other major set of enhancements, so tell me a little bit about that rich client API. You're mentioning when we were talking in the pre-show that it's a kind of a more direct API for developers to use. There's not as many interfaces that you have to deal with. And tell me a little bit about the 20 things as you're talking about that.
Yeah, so that's our idea for reducing the API surface area of the Eclipse framework. So the idea is that if you're just doing something simple, you shouldn't have to learn everything and all the special edge cases that certainly do exist. And over the last, I guess, 10 years of Eclipse development, there have been a lot of edge cases, and that has grown the current API surface to be fairly large. And because of the way the API is structured currently, basically because we're not using dependency injection, because you reach out to other objects, you do things like reach out to the workbench window and then ask it for some kind of service, or you reach out to, you get a reference to the workbench, which then gives you a reference to
maybe selected help, files or something.
Yeah, or the help service even, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which with dependency injection, you just get the help service directly, and this is the API that you use to associate help IDs with certain widgets in your UI, so that if the user presses F1, they get into the right area of the help documentation. And because previously you had to go through these, I call them monster interfaces, because as we added more and more functionality, we had to add more, get help service, get selection service, get handler service, get command service. And there's a whole list of these things on our main interfaces. And if you're just writing a simple view, you don't necessarily need to know about all these things in all their glory and detail. What you care about is you're building an API, and probably you're building it with SWT if you're not using the open social support. And that's just a library that you're using. You're creating some widgets, and that's easy to understand. And then the way you interact with the framework, we're structuring that into these separate services, and we just call them 20 services because that's like give or take, that's the number we're aiming at. So we're looking at things like scheduling background work or the preferences, or how do you signal as an editor that you have unsafe changes and make the code available that needs to run when the user presses on the save button. So that would be editor lifecycle service. I don't know, long-running operations, scheduling background work, and so on. Authentication, maybe. So that would be the first, I don't know, seven, and then there is a couple more.
Mm-hmm. Quick quiz, no. I won't do that to you. And the user interface widgets that you're building, are they based on SWT?
Yes.
And for people who don't know, or maybe are more swing developers, what are the major differences there? Like, what is SWT compared? I mean, I know it's been around for a long time, but...
Yeah. So there used to be a lot of differences back in the days.
Yeah.
And that was the reason why SWT was started in the first place, because at the time, AWT and Swing were just not good enough. I think the main difference is that SWT uses the native widgets. So on Windows, you get the native Win32 controls. On Cocoa, you get the native Cocoa experience. And on Linux, you get GTK. And there's another company actually right now working on a Qt port for SWT.
Oh, neat. So then in that case, I noticed also that I'm working on a Mac. So the only download for the preview version was a Cocoa 64-bit version. I know before everything was written in, what was the other toolkit?
Carbon.
Carbon. That's the one that's been around forever. And then Apple quietly said, everyone's going to be switching from Carbon to Cocoa.
Yeah, and that everyone included us.
You've got
too.
It, yeah.
So we had a major effort porting SWT to Cocoa. And that's the current recommended port of SWT on the Mac. So if you can, download the Cocoa port. And the Carbon port is still good. You can still use it, but it's like ongoing development is going to be on the Cocoa port.
Yeah, and I'm running the Cocoa port now, and it seems nice and smooth. I mean, it looks like a nice transition. It's definitely very Mac-like. So,
yeah, there are a few areas where we're not fully Mac compliant, but we're getting closer and closer.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Let's see here. So in terms of applications you can build with the is it called the E4 API? What are you going to call this new rich client API?
That's a good question. I think so. I'm still calling it E4 because that's the name of the new platform.
Right.
The new leaner and nicer structured platform. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll keep calling it E4.
Okay.
And the old way of doing things we'd probably call Eclipse RCP.
Right. Okay. So with E4, what kind of applications have you seen built?
Well, anything where you would want a rich client. I don't know, if you want to make use of the local processing power, if you have, if you need access to the file system, if it's actually not a client-server application, but it's just a fat client application, or you would use it for anything that is similar to the Eclipse IDE that builds that is a platform onto itself,
right,
where other people can plug in their stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's where Eclipse really excels at, because from the beginning it was built to be open and extensible.
So if you have
it makes
customers-
it really easy to build something where you can have third parties extend your platform.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Companies like JP Morgan are using that. So their banking software is based on all their rich client apps that they're using are built on the Eclipse RCP. And that's because they have a common platform then, and then all the specific applications used by, I don't know, traders and tellers and people like that are plugins into that common platform.
Okay. Now, if you were going to distribute an app based on E4, I guess you just have to bundle up an Eclipse installation and include the bundles in the right place as I guess, well, they're calling it plugins or bundles. But you would put your bundles in like the wherever the provisioning would be, right?
Right. Yeah, and we have our own provisioning technology called P2, mm-hmm. which makes it easy to have your application be updated on the fly. And it's there has been P2 is fairly new. There was a previous provisioning technology that didn't really cut it. And there was some kind of transitioning period. But now it's pretty good. And you can actually, we're testing, for example, that you can take an Eclipse 3.6 and downgrade it to Eclipse 3.5 and then upgrade again to 3.6. Or maybe it's the other way around. You start with 3.5, mm-hmm. upgrade to 3.6, and then you go back. But it's even at that scale, it works pretty well.
Okay. And I read somewhere on that site, on your area of the site, that someone was talking about an application store and an ability to purchase applications. Is that a long-term vision for you guys?
It's a long-term vision for the Eclipse Foundation. So mm-hmm. the Eclipse Foundation has something that they call the Eclipse Marketplace. And that's basically an app store without the ability to actually buy something. Mm-hmm. So it's a catalog. And then if you actually want to get the software, you just install it into your Eclipse. In some cases, you have to buy something to be able to download it. Or you download a demo version and then you buy the key that mm-hmm. unlocks it. And we would like it to be an app store just to make it interesting for developers to offer simple plugins, for example, for the Eclipse IDE that do certain things better and then be able to charge for that without having to set up their own e-commerce websites and stuff like that. But it's actually quite difficult to do for a small nonprofit foundation like the Eclipse Foundation because there's all the different legal problems you have in the different countries, for example.
Yeah.
Fulfillment and so, okay. Yeah, it would be nice to have, but it's certainly a long-term vision.
Sure. So talk to me about the E4 Rover Challenge. I saw that on there. I thought, wow, this is really cool.
Yeah, so that was indeed very cool. We had our annual conference in California, the EclipseCon. That was about 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And one of the keynote speakers was Jeff Norris from NASA JPL. And he had this idea. They're actually using Eclipse RCP as well, similar to JP Morgan. They have their own platform for mission control software, and then all the different experiments and all the different control applications are installed into that platform that they call Maestro. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to know more about E4 or learn more about E4 and offered to put in some of their own time to put together a programming contest at EclipseCon. So the idea was they took a Lego Mindstorms kit and built something that resembled a Mars rover that would sit, like a mini version of that, that would sit at the conference in its own little arena. And then you had to control that rover through an E4-based application.
Oh, neat. Mm-hmm.
And so basically you could see the one of the views was a webcam view from above, and then you had other views for actually making the rover turn or go forward and look at things like the current battery level and other telemetry data, stuff like that. And it was really nice to see the amount of effort that conference attendees put into that rover challenge. The grand prize was a Lego Mindstorms kit plus a trip to NASA JPL to Ooh. Get a VIP tour of their facilities, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Do you remember what the grand prize winner did to win the prize?
So for winning the grand prize, you had to build or improve on the E4-based client that we provided everyone with. So we built something that was very basic, and we asked them to make it easier to use, nicer looking, making use of the E4 APIs. And there were a number of really good entries in that competition. And then there was also a separate competition where you just had to be very good at the the actual tasks that the rover had to perform. It had to move to certain positions in a certain way in a time frame of 3 minutes, and you could collect points. So it was sort of a game.
That's great.
That was a second competition that went on where people basically stayed up late night and got better at controlling the rover and collected points.
That sounds like fun. So you said about sculpting or making the UI look better. You support CSS now for the UI layer, correct?
Right. Yes. So it's CSS-based styling. So it's because the UI is built off SWT widgets, not HTML.
Right.
The CSS looks a little bit different, but it's the same idea. Basically, where you had things like div and span and stuff like that in your CSS, you now have names of SWT controls like composite or a label or a button. Or you just use IDs and class names, and then the CSS looks actually the same as HTML CSS.
Do you see a point in the future where you're going to get closer potentially with this kind of client to something like an Adobe Air where people are going to be able to more easily download these things? Or do you think they solve totally different problems?
Yeah, that's a good question. The web is definitely becoming more important for any kind of software. And that includes the Eclipse platform and maybe eventually even the Eclipse IDE. And so we're looking at that problem, and our current approach is to make it possible for web-based UIs to be hosted inside a rich client or inside the Eclipse IDE in the form of those open social gadgets.
Right.
And then you can imagine, as you have more and more of those open social gadgets, you could just take a collection of those and stick them on a web page. And then that's your application. And what we think we can offer there is our experience with how in Eclipse those views and editors interact and how they're embedded in their host environment, which is something that gadgets... The current open social gadget specification doesn't really address. Right now, gadgets are basically independent things that sit side by side and don't communicate with each other.
Right.
And what you would need for building applications out of these components would be some kind of communication between those gadgets, so that maybe if you hover over a calendar gadget entry, your map gadget shows the location of that meeting, things like that.
So anything else you want to mention about Eclipse, about anything that's upcoming that we didn't cover?
So, yeah, we talked about EMF, the Eclipse modeling framework.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who care, it's interesting to know that E4 is making use of that internally. So we have, in the past, Eclipse has had an application state, right? It's about which views are visible, how are they arranged, which perspective is active, those kinds of things. We've turned that into sort of a DOM now with the help of EMF. So EMF, again, just as a way to have a standard way to talk about a data model or state of your application. So, and with that, we have a very good separation now between the current application state and how it's rendered. And that makes it much more easy for applications not only to be styled using CSS, but also to be rendered using completely different widgets, for example.
That sounds very interesting. Okay.
So it's been a longstanding issue that Eclipse-based application or RCP applications by default always look like Eclipse. And you can sort of see them and recognize them. And that's going to go away, partly because of CSS, but also because of this separation and the ability to plug in your own rendering for the application pieces. So, of course, the inner parts of your application, what's in the views and in the editors, that has always been under your control. But how the outside of the views and the menus and the toolbars look, that has been the Eclipse look with the Eclipse tabs and things like that. And that's now very easy to replace.
Okay, got it. All right, great. Well, I think it's a pretty good overview. So if they want, people want to learn more, I notice you can go to eclipse.org/E4. It's kind of a landing page for this particular incubator.
Correct. And it's I'm not sure if it works with E4 uppercase E. The project name is E4 with the lowercase e, so that's the URL you need to use.
Yeah, I'm checking now. Lowercase is fine, and uppercase is not. So, yes, thank you. It's lowercase E4. That's correct. The number 4. All right. And if people want to get involved, I guess they could just start, you know, scouring the mailing list and submitting what bugs and communicating with people.
Yeah, and at EclipseCon, we actually won the most open project award for all of the Eclipse projects.
Ah, okay.
So if you show up on the mailing list and have some concrete idea what you would like to work on, chances are high that we'll just rope you in and nominate you as a committer.
All right,
very
great.
Soon.
Great. All right. Well, Boris Bukowski, I appreciate you coming on the TechCast and talking about E4. It looks like really interesting stuff.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, thanks. Thanks to Boris Bukowski for speaking about Eclipse E4 in the TechCast. You can find out more information at eclipse.org/E4. More information will be available on our show notes page at techcast.chariotsolutions.com, where you'll find this and many other podcast episodes. Leave us feedback. We'd love to hear from you. You can send us a note on Twitter using the TechCast hashtag. We also tweet as @TechCast, and I'm @KRimple. Our themes today are Free Theme Number 3 and Number 4 from podcastthemes.com. For more information about Chariot Solutions, including our consulting, mentoring, and education services, visit chariotsolutions.com. Over the next several months, we'll have sessions from Philly Emerging Tech, so stay tuned for those. For the TechCast, I'm Ken Rimple.